Yeah, well, last Sunday we asked the question, is God real? And we gave some reasons for believing he truly is. Today I want to ask two more questions. Which God is the true God? And what's he like? Lorraine and I lived for a few months in India, not too far from Bombay. And for the midterm break, we were there, we took an overnight train to Bangalore and visited some of the surrounding sites. Our bus stopped at a famous Hindu temple and we were encouraged to go in. It was like a huge underground cabin. You entered it through this long stone passage that was lit by burning torches. Well, our son Daniel was 3 at that time and he went everywhere in those days on my shoulders. So he and I ventured in. At the end of the passageway there was a large room with a statue of the god, a giant black bull. The priests all wore loincloths, nothing else. But before we reached the inner shrine, Daniel started tearing at my hair and said, "Daddy, this is an evil place, take me out." So I did. I sensed God was at work in him and his spiritual perceptiveness was right on. That place had been designed to instill fear in people. Well, if you visit, you'll discover that India is full of gods. Some of them are kind and some of them are cruel. You can choose the one that best suits you, and nobody really minds which god you worship. The favourite god in the area we were in was the Ganesh, the elephant god. Well, the Hindu thinkers will tell you that they're all manifestations of the great oneness. It only becomes offensive when somebody claims that their God is the only true God and all the others are false, someone like a Muslim or a Christian. Well, the Bible tells us there was a time when people knew the one creator God. When Abraham came into Canaan about 2000 BC, there were still some who believed in the one they called God Most High. And Abraham acknowledges the priest king of Jerusalem, Melchizedek. But when the Israelites came back to the land 400 years later, everything was idolatry. And that was the culture of the ancient Near East from which Hinduism developed. Now, idolatry is a very natural thing. An atheist may tell you that humans invent gods. They do. It doesn't necessarily mean that God is an invention of human beings, but many gods are the invention of human beings. Most people in the world have a sense that there's a supernatural power or powers, and it's natural to give them names and to turn them into objects or to construct a mental image. You've ever heard somebody say, "I like to think God is," and then they will give you their make-up God. They don't kind of think of it that way, but that's what it is. My God would never hurt anyone, a Jewish girl said to me once in an aeroplane. She'd obviously never read the Jewish Bible. She was making God up to be what she wanted. Well, I grew up like that, believing in God, but he was a plasticine God. What I liked, he liked. What I didn't like, he didn't like. I made him up. He was an idol. St. John in his first letter says, "Little children, keep yourself from idols." There are many problems about a false God, but one of them, just one of them, is that when you need them the most, they can't help you. Carl Heim was a physicist, a doctor, and a theologian who lived through the Hitler era, when people made a god out of Hitler. They called him the leader. They loved him. They trusted him. They obeyed him. He held the power of life and death. He could do no wrong. And while everyone was following him, it seemed like he had enormous power. That's what Karl Heim observed. But what he also observed was that that power was actually coming from the worshippers themselves. And when men were dying in the snow at Stalingrad, there was no one to help. So the question we should ask is, which God is the true God? Or can God be known? When God appeared to Moses at the burning bush and sent him back to Egypt to demand the release of the Hebrew slaves, Moses' very natural question was, who shall I say has sent me? I mean, his people had lived for 400 years in the land of many gods, just like India. So which of them is speaking to me now? Which of them is sending me back on my mission? Well, God said a very strange thing at that point. He said, I am who I am. So tell them I am has sent you. And if they want a name, tell them my name is Yahweh, which in Hebrew sounds a little bit like I am, but it's the personal name that God gave to himself. He also said, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Well, in that way he made it clear that the promises that he had made to those men, well, they were real. That was his covenant. So what I said last week, I say it again, that faith in God is only possible because God has made himself known and made promises about the future which are good. Unlike Hinduism and Buddhism and Marxism and big S secularism, Christianity is what it is because the living God has made himself known. That's why, one of the reasons we can't just change things to suit the changing culture as people want us to do. So if God has made himself known, what has he said about himself? That's the next question we come to. Well, I'm sure some of you cringe a little whenever I refer to God as he. I'm deliberately making you cringe. And that's because I believe in one God, the Father Almighty. That's what the Nicene Creed says. It specifies that there's only one God because that's what he's revealed about himself. And he's also made himself known as Father. And he speaks of himself as he. I didn't make that up. He did. I don't know what's meant by it. Or I don't know all it's meant by it. But if that's how God refers to himself, it wouldn't be right to think of it in any other way. Jesus told his disciples, when you pray, say, Abba, Father. Hallowed be your name. Well, that's a very remarkable thing. You know, if you go to the beach at Tel Aviv and you sit there for a while and you just listen to the hubbub, two words will rise above the noise of all the Hebrew speakers having a good time. Imma and Abba, mummy and daddy. Jesus spoke of God as his Abba. And he invited his disciples to do the same. Now, this was new. There's no other religion in the world that does this. Muslims don't call God Father. Allah is distant. He's majestic. He's unknowable. Muslims don't believe you can have a personal relationship with God. They see this as part of the Christian heresy. So when people tell you that all religions are basically the same, blow a raspberry. It's just not true. And this notion of God as our Father and the possibility of having a personal relationship with God, that comes straight from Jesus. And it is consistent through every strand of the New Testament. In the reading from John 10 we had today, Jesus speaks over and over of his Father. The Father knows me and I know the Father. The Father loves me because I lay down my life for the sheep. The Father has entrusted me with a mission. The work I do in my Father's name. No one will ever snatch them from the Father's hand. J.I. Packer has a chapter in his book, Knowing God, about adoption. The Bible teaches that God the Father adopts us when we trust in Jesus and makes us his own children. And Packer says that this is perhaps the greatest of all Christian truths, greater even than the truth of justification. Justification teaches that because of Jesus' death, we are forgiven and we are made in God's eyes as though we had never sinned. And that is wonderful. But it's possible to think that we could be forgiven and then reinstated as God's servants, and that would be a wonderful thing. But God goes a lot further than that. He takes us into his very family, the very family of his beloved one and only Son. And he takes us in as his beloved sons and daughters. So that is indeed a very, very wonderful truth, and it's unique to Christianity. No human religion would dare to claim such a thing. Only because Jesus, who is the eternal Son of God, invites us to share sonship with him, can we ever dare to think such a thing. St. John puts it this way: see what love the Father has given us that we should be called the children of God. And this is what we are. So the next question, or the extension of that question, is to ask, what kind of a God do we have as our Father? Or what kind of a Father is our Father? And to answer that properly, we'd need to explore the whole Bible. Now, this morning all we have time for is that one word, Almighty. Well, it seems pretty obvious that if God created the universe, he must be pretty powerful. Yeah? Well, that's so. But when it comes to the ordinary things of life, suddenly we collapse, become very doubtful and very confused. Well, a chap once stood up when I was preaching in the middle of it, unexpectedly I might say, and he was in anguish. And he said, he was listening to what I was saying, obviously, and was quite unaware of the rest of the congregation. He said, can God heal my epilepsy? Well, it's when you're faced with questions like that that we hesitate. What sort of a father do we have? Rabbi Krishna says there are many things that God would like to do that he can't. He's a loving God, but he's not all-powerful. That's his answer. It's not the Bible's answer. When God spoke to Abraham, he introduced himself as El Shaddai, God Almighty, the possessor of heaven and earth. And as I said, if God created the universe, there's nothing beyond his power to do. Is there? But Abraham thought there was. God had promised him and Sarah a son, which looked pretty impossible back then when Sarah was 70. But when she was nearing 90, and God hadn't spoken for 14 years, Well, it seemed impossible, so Abraham decided he had to do something about it and father the surrogate son through Sarah's maidservant. But that was not God's plan. And Sarah became pregnant at the age of 90. Is anything too hard for God? God said to her when she laughed at the impossibility of what was about to happen. They're very like the words that were spoken to Mary when she was told her child, her cousin, had conceived. With God, nothing will be impossible. So if we're happy about God creating the galaxies, but when it comes to something close to home, can God cure my cancer? Can God get me through this exam? Well, we instinctively think that is impossible. But the Bible teaches us that God is almighty. The only thing that restrains him is his own will. Ah, well, there's the catch, you see. God may be almighty, but does he really want to do this for me? And once again, the Bible comes to our aid. There's a wonderful passage in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12, where Jesus is talking to his disciples about fear. He says, I tell you, my friends, don't fear those who kill the body and after that have no more that they can do. Well, this was a stage in his ministry where Jesus was making many enemies, powerful enemies. John the Baptist had just been executed. And his disciples were getting scared for their lives. They were also worrying about money, their future and the well-being of their families. And Jesus told them not to worry on either score. God is in control and they can trust him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies and not one of them is forgotten before God? Fear not, he says. You are of more value than sparrows. Well, that raises a huge question. Because it's one thing to think about galaxies being created, but can it be true that God cares about every tiny bird and has its destiny in his hands? That's a power we don't often think about. When I think of power, I think of a cyclone, an earthquake, hydrogen bomb, the ocean being stirred up by a storm. It's interesting that, yes, all of those things are God's power. But the Bible also sees God's power, perhaps more often, as holding back the power of the waves, the power of the storm. Thus far and no further. Here shall your proud waves be still. God protects the world from the destructive powers of earthquake, flood, fire and plague. As a kid, you know, I loved Bonfire Night, 24th of May over in the east. We always made this huge bonfire, everything we could lay our hands on sort of went into it. And on Bonfire Night we set fire to it. We had a neighbour who had a dry cleaning business and that was great because he came along with these buckets of old dry cleaning fluid and Chuck, you wouldn't do it these days, but we did then and we thought it was great. You know, he'd throw the bucket of dry cleaning fluid on and it'd go whoosh up to the sky. It was spectacular. But when you think about it, far more impressive than that whoosh of flames is the motor car engine that can control the burning of the fuel and drive hundreds of kilometres on one bucket of petrol. So God's power brought the universe into being. God's intelligence designed the laws that would shape it and make it a place that we could live in. And God's intelligence and power rules everything, from the greatest to the least. Even the hairs on your head are numbered, Jesus said at that time. Well, he doesn't tell the disciples that they won't come to any harm. They may kill you, God may not intervene at the last moment and rescue you. He didn't for his own son. But know if you have to approach, if you have to face death or anything else that you may dread, that the God who has determined the destiny of the sparrow has you in his hands and is working out his perfect plan for your life. He's perfectly in control. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be, said King David. And St. Paul says of God that he works out everything in accordance with his will and plan. So he made the galaxies, all that energy, all that heat, all that power. He also made our world a place of life, and he protects it. Never again will a flood destroy the whole earth, he promised. But could you know? All it would take would be for one area of the earth's surface below the ocean to rise, and the whole world would be flooded out in a matter of days. It happened before, but God has promised that it won't happen again. God also rules the chaos of human instability, establishes rulers and puts them down. He rescued Israel from Egypt. He brought them home from Babylon. One day he will establish them in a new home, in a new world. He raised Jesus from the dead as stage one of that new world plan. And he'll raise you up by that same power. In the meantime, he superintends every detail of every person's life, your life. All things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. I'm quoting Paul there again. There's a lovely thing in that passage in Luke 12 where Jesus is talking with disciples about their fears. He encourages them not to fear in the face of human persecutors. Five sparrows, a soul for a penny. Not one of them is forgotten by God. He also addresses the natural fears they had because they'd set out to follow a homeless wanderer and now things are running rough. And their livelihoods are a worry to them. They've got families to feed. Look at the birds, he says. God feeds them. Think about the flowers. God dresses them better than Solomon ever dressed, and he decks the pastures with their beauty, though they're here today and gone tomorrow. And then as Jesus turns in his thinking from the animals, the birds, and the flowers, he addresses his disciples. At least, he talks now not about the God who clothes the bush with wildflowers, but now he talks about your Father. Your Father knows you need these things. Seek his kingdom, and all these things will be given to you as well. So, God is real, my friends. The one living and true God who is what he is, who is unknowable except as he has revealed himself, who is powerful beyond our imagination, power to create a billion galaxies, power and intelligence to superintend the movement of every electron. Wisdom to determine how to save a human race intent on self-destruction. Power to create a healed world, a renewed universe. And power and wisdom to make a place for you, superintending every detail of your life. Struggling with you against your rebellion against his Father. The God Lord Jesus can save you this sheep of mine hears my voice, and he or she follows me, and I give her eternal life, and he shall never perish, and no one shall snatch him out of my hand. My Father who has given her to me is greater than all. No one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. It's this last statement that we'll begin to explore in 2 weeks' time. Next Sunday we'll explore more closely what it means to believe that God created the heavens and the earth.